The Dennis Devlin Show. You can catch The Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio every Saturday afternoon from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Join me as we travel through the decades and play you the biggest hits from the 60s,
the 70s, the 80s, the 90s and the noughties. That's The Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. The Dennis Devlin Show. We play you
the best mix of music.
How you doing, pal?
Hello, mate. You all right?
I'm all right, mate. It's great to hear from you, mate. It's great. What I'm going to do is I'll start the show. It'll go quite a few things, and I'll start the show, and then I'll introduce you. Alan says, great to talk to you, mate. How are you, and before we start, how are you?
Well, yeah, I'm fine. I've had a bit of traumatic last couple of weeks. I got diagnosed with colon cancer by the doctor, I went and done some tests, but apparently I had all the symptoms, and then I had a sort of a polyp, and then I spent the last week and a half doing like a million tests and going in, and then I got the all clear on the 30th. So yeah, it's been a hectic couple of weeks, but thank God all clear now.
Yeah.
B-man, Chris, be thank God for that, mate. Right, tell you what I'll do is I'll just introduce the show and I'll introduce you, all right, my man?
Right, so I'm just going to shut this door because I've got there's a bit of music coming in, yeah?
Yeah, it's all right, mate. It'll go quiet for a second anyway.
All right, nice one.
Well, good afternoon.
Hi.
Three, two, one. Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio. And we are blessed and very lucky to have the amazing Terry Ellis. Good afternoon, Terry. How are you?
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm fine, Dennis.
Terry, it's been an interesting few weeks for you. I've just been talking to you off air. You know, firstly, I'm glad you're well, mate. That's the most important thing, and it is good to hear that.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
No, you're very welcome, mate. Now, a lot of people will probably know who you are. I surely don't need to go into too much detail. Most will know Terry as an author and a man who, of course, has worked with the charity to help those that have, how can we say, been in, not had the best of life. Is that a fair way to put it, Terry?
Yeah. Not the best advantages in life.
No. And of course, Terry, for those who don't know you, of course, you are the mastermind they call you, behind the famous 2007 $4 million heist at the Verizon Business Center. Wow.
Yeah, it's called Verizon. It was a £5 million pension chip robbery. But what a lot of people didn't realize until we actually just released the book, that we actually went in for the data. The data was worth just over £100 million.
Wow. Of course, it was all chips, wasn't it? And obviously the information on there.
Well, the chips were just over 5 million. But what we actually went in there for was the information. We tried to keep it secret as we could until we released the book, but we had MI5 on us for the last 8 years. Trying to get the motherboards and data back, but they wasn't very successful.
Yeah, I mean, Teddy, most folks sit there and, you know, most career criminals think about robbing banks and stuff. You've done all that. At what point, how did you come to the idea of, you know what, this is what I'll do. This will be unique and this will be different. How did you get to that point, Teddy?
We was doing robberies when we were young kids, and So we had to, you know, as we got older, we went into the drug game, and we decided that really we need to do something that's not going to, you know, give us a lot of bird, you know, get a lengthy prison sentences.
Yeah.
Sorry, you know, my dog's going a bit crazy.
It's all right. It's good to have him on board.
That sounds. It's a little bit of an electric fit every time someone rings the doorbell. Do you want to start it again? Sorry, mate.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, we'll go again. Ready? Three. All right,
she's a rescue. I got to see, she's actually a rescue dog, so she's a little bit temperamental. But I'm just gonna open. I'm just gonna open it. I don't know. Did you order something? No. Oh, come here. Kill your fuck here. Sorry.
Sorry.
Let's go shut this dog. I just want to find me someone. Yeah. Cheers. Right,
we'll go again. Ready?
Sorry, I really apologize for that.
No, I don't apologize, man. Mate, don't apologize for anything at all, mate. Not on this show, mate. Are we ready? Three, two, one. Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio. And this afternoon, we are joined by author Terry Ellis. Good afternoon, Terry, and how are you?
Yeah, good afternoon, Dennis. Really pleasure to be here.
Terry, firstly, to start off, I'm glad you help as well. I've just spoke to you off air, and obviously, I was made aware of the situation. So most importantly, it is good and great to know that you're of good health.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Ah, you're welcome, mate. It's, you know, it's a frightening thing to go through, obviously. I'm not going to go into detail on it. It's nobody's business. But, you know, when you're dragged along that sort of thing, it's the waiting and all that, waiting to find out. So it's great news to hear that, Terry.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
So, Terry, of course, you're an author. And, of course, you're also involved in a very important charity. We'll get onto that later. And you did some work at a particular prison, which we'll talk about. But firstly, let's talk about, is it the Verizon business robbery? Of course. Now, a lot of folk don't know. It wasn't just about chips, was it, Terry?
No, it was about data.
And what gave you the idea? And obviously, you'd been involved in other stuff, you know, the criminal business of drugs. Not obviously gets you a bit too much bird and brings a bit too much heat on. You obviously decided to expand and do something much smarter. And you are, of course, you're the original Ocean's 11.
Yeah, yeah. I think we just sort of broke the mold as far as a robbery's concerned. I remember, you know, back in 2007, 2006, 2005, lots of people were nicking Penty and chips, and you know, you can nick a van, you can nick £4, 5, 6 million. Yeah. And then the insurance paid people dictated that you could only carry about £350,000. So to actually go out robbing vans actually became like not really worth it, because time you broke it up and sold it, it was only worth 20, 30, maybe 100,000 quid to you and your crew. So it wasn't very lucrative. However, we were offered a job at Verizon Business Center because it was one of the biggest communication centers in Europe. JP Morgan and lots of other banks had all their data there. And we were fast learning that data really was the new currency. Penny and chips as well was still fetching good money on the market. So we was offered a job, and we were probably the first team that actually realized the advantages of actually going in and getting the data. So so in 2008, we done Verizon. And the thing about that, we never took any guns or anybody, simply because we dressed up in police as police officers. We worked at we was a fast response robbery squad. There was 11 security guards in there, and we took an Alsatian dog of us as well. So we had police vans, police dogs, and we pulled up and
just walked in.
We basically just knocked on the door. You know, they had you know, the normal six layers of security there. You know, where the perimeter, they have a facade, and they have the doors, the entry doors. They have a biometric alarm system, keypad entries, 24-hour protection. It was crazy, and they also had an independent monitoring service that used to watch them doing their job, which we had to go in and actually cut that feed. But going in as police really just gave us an opportunity to get all the way to where you wanted to do it without getting any grief. And also not hurting anybody.
Well, I mean, I remember reading the story about the Lufthansa robbery, and that was almost similar. They just walked straight in and walked out with ridiculous amounts of money from an airport. But there was a lot more planning. There must have been an awful lot of planning to go into that. I mean,
I spent 4 weeks on it, 4 or 5 weeks on this one in particular, just going around it, looking at it. There was actually on this one, there was a job in America when they actually went in first to get the data. They actually went for a wall. They missed the data. Then the data got moved to England through JP Morgan and Verizon. I didn't realize at the time that but the information held on it was to do with the prime mortgages. So a lot of influential people or banks would have probably seen a run on their banks if that information would have got out. That's why we were actually tasked with going to Verizon and actually taking every single motherboard that was on the particular set of in the floor there, and we had to retrieve every single one of them because that was our assignment. And we went in there and we spent an hour in there. I think we managed to tie up 11 security guards, technicians. I think all in all was 16 people. But we went under the guise that we was a fast response robbery team. We had information that there's someone had gained entry through the roof who was dressed as a security guard, and then for our protection and my officer's protection, we had to cuff everyone in until we actually found the person, you know, and they never realised until we actually walked out of there that we wasn't real police officers, because we was all dressed in full kit, and we all had walkie talkies, and we kept to the pretense and right to the moment we actually left when we took the motherboards.
Wow, I mean. Yeah. What was it like afterwards? I mean, the adrenaline must have been going. And of course, you've obviously not got to worry about fencing them off, because you've obviously got somebody to fence them off for you already, haven't you?
Yeah, we've gone for them, yeah. Yeah, you know, it was I think, you know, any person who does this, you know, they're looking at that one score in their whole life that really, you know, sort of they can look back and say, you know what, that was a job that actually went, everything that went right. From the minute we went down there, it was just, it went like, you know, it's like poetry in motion. But we, you know, we had done, you know, we had rehearsed for weeks how we was going to do it, and to see it just click into place, because we was in there for 1 hour, you know, when you consider there was 3 police stations, And also there was an independent security company that monitored the room that we did. So what we did just at the right time when we secured everybody else, we cut that feed, and I went down to the reception and they phoned up and I said there's been a surge in the mainframe computer and all the cameras have gone down. They'd be up in 20, 25 minutes. A little bit like Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. It's very similar. So, you know, when we done the same, when we shut it down, we shut down four or five countries and their banking systems for, I think, 6 or 7 hours at one time. So, yeah. So, but getting back to the original question, you know, I think when you go into one of these jobs, you know, for weeks or days and days before, your anxiety levels are up, your fear levels are up. But the minute you start doing it, you're really calm. You know, we practice and practice and practice. And when we do it, we're really calm. You know, you wouldn't think that we wasn't police officers. We had it rehearsed so well that even we convinced ourselves that we were police officers, you know.
Wow. Teddy, what was it like for a young Teddy growing up in London? What was it like for you growing up?
You know, I got put into care when I was very young. I got put into the care system. But before I went into care, you know, I came from a very poor family. So from a very young age, from say, you know, 8, 9, 10, I was going out robbing or stealing from warehouses in the area. You know, we used to go in the middle of the night. You know, I used to jump on trains. I used to take all the stereos out of the cars that were going to Dagenham. And I'd end up going 4 or 5 miles on the train and just nicking all the stereos out and then dropping them in black bags as I was going along. And then jumping off like, and then walking all the way back to King's Cross and picking up the bags as I went. And, you know, I'd do 20 or 30 radios. And we were selling for a couple hundred pounds.
And obviously, there was obviously, you know, we talk about there are certain jobs that criminals don't like to do because it brings heat. And obviously, drugs was a problem later on in time. You got involved a little bit in the drug trade and all. Did you not think to yourself at that time, you know, this is heavy. This is, if I get involved in this, I'm looking at some heavy time. Or did you just think, you know, it's the dollar, isn't it? Make the money.
Yeah, I left a community home at 15, and I went into doing armed robberies. You know, by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I'd probably done 30, 40, if not more, post offices and building societies. And then I'd done a prison sentence. And you know, when I came out, I decided that maybe this was enough. You know, my life, you know, needed a different direction. Unfortunately, I actually went on holiday to Spain and realized that I could actually buy as much puff and everything else very cheap and sell it very expensive in England. So I then spent the next 20, 30 years doing that. 20-odd years doing that.
Yeah, there was a time when, because you could bring it straight into the south of England, couldn't you? Pretty much straight into Essex and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, you know, I spent quite a lot of years just running the gear myself. So what I did, I used to go over to Marbella, I used to buy it and then wrap it, seal it, and drive it up to Valencia, and then put it on a lorry, and then I would retrieve it. You know, and then we would sell it. You know, it was very, very lucrative. It was very quick, and it was a really good turnover. You know.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. I suppose for once, you instead of in a jail, you're living the high life for a bit, aren't you? Oh, I've lost Teddy. Still there, Teddy? I think I've lost him. You know that. Must have got a call.
Hey.
Got ya. Yeah, back, mate. Got ya. I was just losing your signal there, mate.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Teddy. I got you back there, mate. You're back.
Sorry, mate. I don't happen there. Just cut off.
That's all right. Sorry. I mean, it must have been quite a lucrative business, and you must have been living for quite a nice little lifestyle for a while.
Yeah, you know, I was living in Marbella. I was going back and forth to England, and you know, I was going to all the restaurants, the clubs in Port of the Nouveau, lovely cars, lovely girlfriends, and I was living a real good life. And then, unfortunately, one of my guys that we used to do the driving with, he died in a car crash. So I ended up going to Amsterdam, and I was working over there for about a year. And we were then working from there back into England, and then unfortunately a friend of mine who I was working with got killed, and the other one he got shot and paralysed. So that's why I thought, you know, I better get out of Dodge and come back to England.
Yeah.
And I ended up in France, and as soon as I got to France, I met some friends of mine, and they asked me if I could organise some transport doing some cigarettes. So I spent the next, I think, 2 years doing that, and then I eventually came back to England.
And of course, the irony is, it all caught up with you in the end. It caught up with you at the worst possible time. And I'm guessing at this time, you've got family responsibilities, and of course, it happened in front of your children. You had to confess.
I came back to England, and I think my girlfriend there was a girl called Sunshine Frost. Her sister was Sadie Frost, and her husband was Jude Law. And the best friend is Kate Moss, and I was going out with them every night, you know, having a real great time. You know, I think for 6 years we were just having a real good buzz, and, you know, just really enjoying myself. And I was actually selling lots of cocaine at that time. And I went to I think it was 9/11, the day after 9/11. I went to pick up some gear, and then the police flopped on me, and I ended up getting 6 years, and that was wow. That was my wake-up call. And I lost my houses, I lost my girlfriend, and I had to start all over again. And so for me, it was really just trying to find something I was really good at, you know. And unfortunately, being a criminal, we revert back to type. And for me, it was robbery. So, but instead of doing armed robberies, I started really doing doing robberies that didn't really involve carrying guns or hurting anybody. So we decided that maybe the police uniforms would be the best way forward. So I got a team together, a very experienced team that I've worked with for years, and we carried on doing the penny and chips, and it was so easy. You know, it's like taking candy from a baby most days, and we worked probably once or twice a year. So yeah, it was actually a better game, because in the drug game, we worked, you know, 365 days a year. And like anything, you've only got to get a look at once and you're nicked and you're doing 10 or 15 years. Yeah, with this game, is, you know, we'd look at a place and we'd do it, and then we'd have 6 to 10 months off, and then we'll come back and regroup and then do another one. And it seemed really to fit my sort of lifestyle, because as you know, most criminals are really lazy, and no more so than me. You know,
is that right, Teddy? You're lazy.
Oh yeah, we want everything for nothing. We think we've got self entitlement, you know. And if you add being in care and everything else, then you've got all the ingredients for someone that really doesn't give a monkeys about anything apart from himself. It's full faults, because I have to take responsibility for my own actions. I just didn't like work. I was never academically astute, or never academically good at school. I had dyslexia. And, you know, instead of actually knuckling down and doing what most people do and learn, you know, I decided that, you know, there was a shortcut for me, and it meant taking things that really didn't belong to me, you know. And that was, you know, that is because it was so much easier, and it didn't involve any studying, you know. And I realized I was quite good at it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's difficult when you grow up in that situation, that there is very limited opportunities for yourself, and sometimes crime is the only way. You know, people can judge folk on that, and that gets me to more than my past, which is very important, about people judging folk, you know, without knowing, you know, the past. And tell me a little bit about More Than My Past.
You know, More Than My Past is really just about me really reinventing myself. So what happens in 2000, and I was arrested, and I ended up going to therapy into a place called Grendon Underwood.
Grendon,
yeah, it's a therapeutic prison, but it holds some of the worst criminals in England, some of the most depraved, you know, rapists, paedophiles, child killers, and a token recidivist or armed robber like me. I volunteered to go there simply because, well, I've never really volunteered. I was actually asked to go there by a psychologist, because I never had no fear. I never had no empathy, no fear. And what I was doing, and which I thought was really normal, I realized wasn't. So I actually signed up and went there, and there was 228 men there, some of the worst, you know, some of them are the worst in society. And I had to do therapy. Yeah. But what it was about looking at your past to create a better future. So like looking at your childhoods, you know, as we normalize things as children. So what I did, I normalized my childhood and my upbringing, but I also used it as an excuse to do what I wanted. Yeah. So going in there to actually look at myself and reevaluate what I did and really come to terms with the fact that it was abnormal. It was, you know, was something that really set me up for a new beginning, so to speak. So I spent 2.5 years there, and going into therapy was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, because I had to talk about childhood. I had to talk about my upbringing. It was really quite a hard time, but I said, you know, I came through it, and I wrote a book called Living Amongst the Beasts. You know?
Yeah, that's what I'm just going to talk about now. I was just opening it up the note. I mean, I'm sort of reading some of it just now. I mean, it's an amazing book, isn't it? I mean, the headline, I think the name of the book sort of sums it up, doesn't it?
Well, you know what? It's very provocative. It's very provocative. But you know what? Yeah. It teaches you about, if we talk about the thing that actually drives people to kill, like ego, embarrassment, shame, you know, what we're learning now, I learned about my ego, shame, embarrassment, and what actually drives me. And then I realized that all these things don't physically hurt me, but where I was never able to actually analyze them and look at them for what they were, I then retaliated, you know, against people because of it. You know, so it's like, because, you know, violence for a very long part of my life was one of my currency, you know, just using violence, you know. So to get a handle on it, you know, it's probably one of the best things for me going forward, you know. Coming out of prison. So, yeah, I an easy way of putting it really is a, you know, when if you have an altercation with someone, you know, most of the time you'll walk away from it, you'll go, you know what, you know, if only I'd never said this or only never said that, you know, and then you convince yourself that next time it happens, I'm gonna be articulate. And then as soon as it happens 6 months later or a year later, you revert back to type again. But the good thing about going to therapy is you was in a conflict resolution every single day, and you learn from that experience. So when you do come against it on the outside world, you actually learn to articulate instead of reverting back to violence or profanity, which is normally the catalyst for actually full violence. And the good thing about Grendon is that even though it's not a medicine that cures recidivism and everything else, deviancy and everything else, you know, the biggest thing I learned there was that most of the men that went there, instead of using violence, they started to articulate, which was one of the best things because there was actually no violence in Grendon whatsoever, you know, compared to a mainstream prison, simply because people were able to talk about their feelings and thoughts and feelings, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that must have been really hard for you at first. I mean, you're a straight ace guy, you're a, you know, career criminal, and you're sitting here suddenly with, I guess, what most folk would describe as the scum and all. They would look at him as, oh, you don't want to, what would you want to be with them? I mean, it must have been hard not to kind of, you know, just respond with your fist and crack some of them. No, that's the whole, that was the whole point.
Well, you know, the hardest thing was tolerance. You know, I never suffered football gladly all my life, you know, and I always resorted to violence at the first opportunity. But to actually learn tolerance was one of my biggest things. Because I could, you know, like, you know, just for argument's sake, I'm talking to someone who's killed their kid. You know, one guy, he killed his daughter, you know, and he's talking to me as if he's a victim. And, you know, trying to explain to me that it wasn't his fault. So when you're up against that all the time, it's really easy to actually use their offences against them, which normal people would do. But I had to get to the stage in my therapy where I couldn't use their offences against them. I had to use articulation. And that's what it taught me all the way through it. You know, I met some of the worst people that killed their mums, dads, girlfriends, husbands, boyfriends, and everything else. But instead of using their offences, I was able to articulate a response back to them instead of using profanity So I learned tolerance. I learned to control my ego. I learned to control my shame, my embarrassment. If you talk about the majority of killings that happen inside, you know, I met so many young guys in prison that were ashamed of their sexuality. So what they did, they would then meet someone, they would have a sexual encounter with it, but they'd be so embarrassed and so shameful afterwards that they would actually kill that person. But they would rather kill that person than actually just explain the fact that they are gay. So it was a real. So for me, you know, going to prison and doing that was a real eye opener. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. And because you spent what 15, 16 years of your life, most of that in jail. So I mean, I see just over maybe over half your life spent in prison, learning a certain way, and then to go to a prison like that and see things from, I suppose, from a different angle. I mean, it's clearly changed you. I mean, I read a lot about you, and we're going to get onto this, the work you do and to promote the safety. I mean, obviously you live in London and we all know knife crime in London and violence in London is increasing. And it is down to stereotypical ego. I mean, that's how I see it. It seems these people have got an ego. If you do something, you've got to do something back. Somebody comes on your patch, you've got to answer back. And you set up your own social enterprise, which in Camden, I believe.
What we did, we set up with Camden Against Violence to start with, because my girlfriend, she works in the school, and in her class, she had two boys, and 6 months apart when they left school, they both died within 6 months of each other by being stabbed, and they were only 16, and one was 17. And then we had a spat of murders. We had in one weekend. One guy got assassinated on the crossing by being shot. One guy was decapitated in Camden Town, and one young girl was stabbed in the stomach and killed. Within 8 months, I think we had 8 killings. So we started Camden Against Violence to actually try and highlight the fact that this was happening, and we wanted to actually create something that would benefit the kids, so they could actually go there and there was somewhere that they could get in touch with. They could get in touch with me. But if any kids in the area had a problem with knife crime or being bullied or anything, they can actually contact me, or they can contact someone in Camden Against Violence. And after that, we then created another one called Change Your Life to Gain Your Knife. Yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, that's got to like 20,000 members. And what we do with that, we organise boxing tournaments. We get kids off the street with boxing lessons and everything else. So, and English, maths, we teach them. You know, we get put them into education, and it's all voluntarily. You know, we do it off our own backs. I work with a guy called Ben Spann, and he runs the actual Change Your Life, Put Down Your Knife campaign. And I contribute. We've got ambassadors in each area that contribute and offer their services to help kids in the area.
Absolutely amazing, Terry. You know, and it has highlighted some of the, you know, what we see up north. You know, you see these young boys dying in the streets, you know, for literally nothing. You say 16, 17 year old, their lives are gone. And it's great that guys and you can go out there and connect, especially as your life experiences, you can discuss that with them. And you don't seem the kind of guy that looks back and thinks, you know, I really loved my time. You know, you don't seem, you know, I guess. You're not looking for forgiveness, but I think you've earned your forgiveness, and I think you've earned your right to be considered.
I think what it was for me, I never felt no shame about my past. So you know what, it was actually quite easy to say that I've done 20 years in prison. But you know what, I've actually learned quite a lot. I've learned how to deal with men.
Yeah.
I've learned how to look at people's egos. I've learned how to talk about reinforcement. Seeing all the behaviours. So you know, and I understand them. So it's actually. Also, people respect me simply because I've lived that life. And unfortunately, they'd rather talk to me than someone who's been to university, which is wrong, I suppose. But unfortunately, you know, I can engage better with them, you know. So, you know, I've actually just read a book. It should be coming out just after Christmas. It's about everything that I learned in Grendon. It's about early intervention. So, you know, I've talked about all the behaviours, you know, again, the ego, the embarrassment, but also about conflict resolution, anger management. And putting in place certain things that actually, you know, all the lessons I learned, all the epiphanies that I learned are all in that book. The same as living amongst the beast. You know, so
do you not think these books, the government should be taking these books and putting them into schools? You know, these books should be put into schools where children can read them, because they're so important, because sometimes you need to hear it. I know, because I'm a kid who grew up in the East End of Glasgow, and, you know, when I grew up, it was quite a tough, you know, there was nobody there to sort of tell us, and the only people that could tell us anything good were the people who had lived it, you know, and I just wish that I'd picked a book up or something and taught me about violence and stuff and how to address these situations, because I grew up the same as you. I answered everything with a fist, you know, that's how, on my head, you know. And nobody was ever there. No one like you was there to say to me, listen, pull me to one side and show me the dangers, but also show me there's ways. And, you know, these books that you write should be in schools.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Living Amongst the Beasts and The Final Countdown to My Freedom I wrote as well. And Verizon, really, they're a trilogy of books that go from crime to going to therapy and then coming out of prison. But, you know, and also, you know, it's really about really having the desire to change. You know, unfortunately, you know, hindsight's a great thing, but we never listen to anyone's hindsight. I suppose reading something, you know, really is a way of people actually understanding it better. But I think people need to learn from their own experience, but you really need to have a desire to want to change. And that's what we're trying to get across to people. You know, I've been working, talking to MPs and in government, I think, because they do a load of courses, a rehabilitation course in prison, that are academic, and they really just don't work. And I think for the last 20 years, they've been doing the same thing. And, you know, I think the crime rate and the reoffending rate has gone up, you know, so much. Yeah, I think it's 75% now. You know, so it's I think it's proof enough that the rehabilitation in its present form doesn't work. So for me, I tried to go in and say, no, we need to empower these guys with education. We need to empower these guys with a trade. You know, if you're inside for 5 years, why aren't you coming out a fully qualified electrician or plumber or carpenter? Why are they sitting in their cells doing nothing? But also education. So for me, I think if someone left prison with somewhere to live, a half decent education and a trade, then you're setting that car up to succeed. Unfortunately, you know, I'm talking 99.9% of people leaving prison actually leave homeless. Now,
you were homeless, weren't you?
Yeah. I left prison with a tent, simply because, you know, there's nothing outside now that's geared up for people leaving prison. Even though I say that. Statistically, you know, the prisons will tell you that 92% of ex-offenders leaving prison actually leave with someone to live, which is a complete lie. However, on paper, it's actually correct. And the way they get around it is when you leave prison, you get a travel warrant, and to get that travel warrant, you have to give an address. So that's then classed as a successful rehousing. And if that doesn't work, the day that you actually leave prison, you have to give an address. You know, you can't leave prison without giving an address or a postcard, a code, I mean. And that is classed as successful rehousing, even though you're leaving no fixed abode. And this is why their figures show that they got a 92% success rate of housing expenditure, when in fact it's actually nil. Because most offenders leave prison just living on someone's city, you know, or most of them just live on the street until they find somewhere. But any good will...
Huh? Well, you tell me, didn't they actually ask you to give us your park bench, your postcode?
A few days before I left prison, I said, I haven't got anywhere to live. I'm getting a tent delivered. And they said, well done. And they said, I tell you what I do, Terry, as soon as you get back to London, please contact us and give us your postcode. And that way we can actually come and visit you. And at least we know exactly where you are. And I said, is that it? And this is after doing 8 years of rehabilitation, all the courses that they said, and under the proviso, they was going to put me into a hostel until I actually got myself a job. But even at the last knock-ins and going to a DCAT, I expected to go out to work so I could actually save some money up and get a rent deposit scheme. But that unfortunately, it doesn't exist in open conditions now, because you can't actually go out to work, because they have to have half the prison working inside to actually... Because otherwise it's not allowed to run. It can't run. So depending on what time you get there, you won't get a job in that last year, which is farcical, simply because any good intentions you had of changing your life, you know, it goes out the window, simply because you go out with no money, nowhere to live. And most people will revert back to type and go and commit an offence again. Yeah. You know, which is crazy, and which most of them do. I was actually extremely lucky that I have a support network. which involves my family and my girlfriend. And if I never had that, I would probably I'd probably have missed the opportunity to write 10 books and I've started up two businesses. I would have missed that opportunity simply because of not being helped, you know. But, unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast.
And do you go into the prisons, Terry, now? Do you actually go in and talk to these youngsters in jail?
Well, I'm actually banned from going to prison.
That's what I was wondering.
Because anyone who speaks any common sense is actually pushed aside. You know, if I started talking about doing academia, these courses that they do, they do 6-week courses, and what happens in prison for reoffending is that you would go into a classroom and they would ask you 150 questions, and you won't have a clue what's happening. What they had to answer them questions, but for the next 6 weeks they're going to tell you every single question, and then at the end of that 6 weeks they then ask you the same questions again, and you answer all of them. But that's classed as a success, you know. All you're doing is regurgitating what they've done. So rehabilitation, really, it's farcical. And it's the same, you know, whether it's anger management, whether it's thinking rehabilitation, about thinking about your offence. You know, I spoke to hundreds, if not thousands of men over the years that have done all these courses. And they would tell their probation officers, they would tell anyone that would listen that they work, simply because if they told the truth, they wouldn't get out. Most of them are lifers. So they have to say, well, you know, I've learned so much and it's a brilliant course. The reality is that 99.9% of the guys that go on these courses will tell you straight away afterwards they're not worth the paper they're written, you know. So, but it doesn't work. And as I said, it's a perfect example of why year on year, you know, people are returned to prison that have been, you know, within the first 5 years, in the first 2 years, first four years, and 2 years and 3 years, simply because it doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, and they don't, same way the addictions, drug addiction, they don't seem to address that. They seem to release these people that have got drug problems or alcohol problems. Firstly, some prisons don't even class alcohol as an addiction nowadays. You know, it's like a pat on the back of one, man up and get out. You know, and these people are expected to just get on with it.
The biggest cottage industry is not heroin and spice in prison. It's prescription drugs. You know, because
codeine, tramadol.
Yeah, they got private service providers in prison that have shareholders to appease and pay. So what they do, they hand out prescription drugs in prison like confetti. You know, I remember years ago, you go into prison, you'll see four or five people at the hatch. Now you'll see queues a mile long because it's important that they give out more prescription because they get more money. So they're actually turning people into, you know, into being dependent on prescription drugs, which is crazy. And What I did find that came through loud and clear was, if you've got a drug problem inside prison and you're really on one, you know, most charities won't actually take you on board because it's not in their interest, because you're too much aggravation to them. Most of these drug charities will only take on people that have stopped taking drugs because they're manageable, you know, and they can work for nothing for weeks and weeks and weeks in their fucking, sorry, Twitter, in their hostels or their places of residence or everything, because they got great mansions and houses. And, you know, it's like some of them do a great job and they got some good stuff, but they won't take on the problem are people that actually really need the help because they are too much expense to them. So most of the people leaving prison, and most of the guys I noticed that were going to rehabilitation centers weren't even taking drugs. They just professed that they were taking drugs so they can have somewhere to live, which is crazy. And the people that need it go back on the street. And these are the 40% of the revolving door of recidivism, because they just keep coming in and out because they're not being properly looked after.
It's shocking. You, I mean, if you, what are the three? What would you like to say? When we've got MPs listening, you know, what's your message right now today? What would you like to say? What could you tell people? What do you want to tell them?
You know what? For me, it's really just empowering these guys when they come out. You know, the most important thing for anyone is somewhere to live. You know, if you can give someone somewhere to live and you can give someone a job where they can, you know, for me, I would encourage employees, and if I was a government body, I would actually pay the employers to employ these, you know, employ these guys coming out of prison, because most of them will work 110% because they all want to change. You know, they really do want to change. You know, so, you know, if you give them a job, but help the employer employ these guys by paying them a subsidy to help them employ them. Yeah. And then you'll see you'll see these guys. They once they get some self-worth, they will excel. And they most of them are really intelligent. And most people that go to prison, people think they're either junkies or they're burglars. That's not the case. You know, I think 90% of the guys that I met in prison were well educated. They had all the advantages in life, but they just went off the rails. You know, so most of the guys who do come out are well educated. They're looking for jobs, but they just seem to get mixed up in that revolving door simply because there's nothing at the end to actually help them. You know, we spend £40,000 a year on these guys in prison. But the minute they actually want something outside any help, we then say we can't help you simply because it's not cost effective. It's actually more cost effective to go in prison than what it is out. And that's what we need to look at.
Address that. Yeah, that needs addressing. Yeah. I mean, how do you feel the press could do? Do you feel they could do more in promoting wise? I mean, they tend to like a glory story, don't they? They'll talk about a person being stabbed quite happily. Yeah. And up here, but they won't go into detail about what led to that stabbing, if that makes any sense, Terry.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, you know, well, you know, it's all about sensationalism as far as the press are
concerned. That's it, yeah.
And, you know, even now, you know, I get approached by the media, and all they're concerned about is me putting kids in balaclavas and holding a knife or a gun, because that's sensationalism. You know, and I've done a campaign saying I don't want to see any more kids on television, Channel 4, ITV or BBC One, with balaclavas on. Because, you know what, all that does is encourage other kids and say, you know, it actually legitimizes them as gang people.
That's
because
once
they
see it,
because they all want it then. So, well, I'm going to go on there now, and we're going to wear our guns, and we're going to put everything out there, and we're going to show that who we are. So all of a sudden, you've got this crazy, they're trying to outdo each other with what they can actually show on television. It's crazy. So for me, you know, I think, it has to stop. We have to stop dressing kids up in balaclavas and brandishing guns and knives, because there are so many good kids out there that do really well. You know, but we don't hear about them. We don't hear the kids that are going to the academies, that are going to the workshops and actually trying to improve it, because there are a lot more kids doing better in this community than there are doing bad. But for some reason, we don't actually talk about them. You know?
No, we don't promote it. We tend to ignore it. We, like, say, sensationalization. And our documentaries like to, like, say, promote these kids. And these kids are using it as well as YouTube and social media. And I think social media has a great role to play in this and could do a lot more. Because, you know, you see some taunting going on there between gangs and stuff like this. And then, you know, you'll get a particular channel documentary will come in and talk to that area, and they'll talk to them and say where they're from and allow them to promote their own kind of agendas, which of course is taunting the gang. And I think social media has a great responsibility to stop this and promote something differently.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like anything else. You know, the media are, you know, I'm not going to say they're the puppets of the MPs, because, you know, we talk about free press in this country, but it's not free press. You know, because it all depends who owns it. It's their narrative, yeah. So what I have found is that what they do, they build up an area that's really, really bad in knife crime. You know, we're going to take Camden Town, where I come from, for instance, and we're going to look at a certain area called Agar Grove, which is quite prolific as far as gangs and stabbings are concerned. But over the last 8 years, what they've done, they've torn down all the council estates, and they've gentrified them and moved them out. Now, what better disguise that you can use and say that, you know, the streets are running alive with kids, feral kids stabbing each other. So what we're going to do, we're going to move them. And everyone's going to be clapping and cheering from the rafters. But the fact is that they're moving these kids out into the sticks. They're moving them out to where they've got no family networks or whatever. But, you know, but because the houses they live in are a premium. So I can understand why the press are really, you know, shouting from the rooftops about knife crime and stabbings in different areas, because, you know, you look at Hackney. They've done it in Hackney. Now Hackney is like is gentrified. They've done it in Brixton. They've gentrified Brixton. Notting Hill. You know, these places, you go down in there, they're like, it's like walking into a completely different place. It's unbelievable. But they've moved everybody out. They've moved the problem somewhere else. They're not dealing with the problem. They're just moving it. But in the same breath, they're actually reclaiming London as somewhere that only the rich can.
Yeah, I read somewhere a great comment. He said what they're actually doing, the local government's actually doing, is shopping in Aldi but putting it into Marks and Spencer's bags, if that makes any sense. And I thought that was a great
comment. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think if we look back at and look at at prison now, you know, like mental health in prison. You know, I can remember back in the '70s, yeah, or late '70s when they, no, 79, I think it was, when they brought out the care in the community. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, it was I remember that.
So what they did, they shut down all the mental homes, yeah? And they said, like, you know what we do? You know, these people have had enough being in mental homes. What we're going to do, we're going to give them their own flats and we're going to let them look after themselves. So what they did, they shut down all the mental homes and they sold it off to private developers and they earned millions and millions, hundreds of millions of pounds. And all these people that went into the care in the community couldn't function in the community. So what they did, they criminalized them. Now, if you go into a prison, you'll see wings and wings and wings of people with mental health problems, but they've criminalized them. And the biggest problem inside prison really now is not the fact that there's lots of prisoners going in there. The fact that there's more people with mental health issues in there than any time in the history of prison.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. You know, so they created another problem. They created it for the prison officers because none of them are actually trained in mental disorders. Or whatever. So, you know, they're playing catch up. That's why the prison system now is in chaos.
Yeah. And do you feel training is important? I mean, do you feel that it's possibly time to basically break down the entire system and rebuild it and include training on mental health and understanding estate life, you know, maybe because some of the prison officers clearly don't understand what's actually happening in their own prison. They follow rank and file and do exactly as they're told and perhaps are not connecting. So maybe it's time to pull it all down and start again with a program that will actually encourage, you know, to look at things differently, including mental health, you know, social aspects like out on the outside. Because some of the prisons that I've talked to, some of the prison officers, I spoke to a prison officer from Kilmarnock Prison, and he said, we're told to just put them in the cells, lock them up, then let them out, let them play about on the pool table and put them back in the cell. Don't communicate with them. Don't get too close to them, you know.
That's it, yeah.
That still creates the us against them, but yeah. not accepting that there's people in there with mental health problems. You know what's going to happen. We're going to lead to suicide increase. We're going to lead to violence in prison increase. And when they come out, it's not been addressed. And it's how do we address that? How would you address that? What would you do to change the prison system?
Well, I think since 2011, I think we've had 3,600 suicides of men leaving prison. There's no investigation, no accountability, and no one really cares. So that's that. You know, the amount of people that leave and commit suicide is actually astronomical, you know, and it needs to be looked at. But because they're criminals, and no one cares. You know, as I said before, you know, we look at the Scandinavian countries where they've adopted, you know, they don't bang you up for 20 years. You know, the longer the sentence doesn't work. You know, I do believe in locking paedophiles, rapists, child murders, and murders up for a very long time. If you've got somebody who's in, you know, got drugs and drug problem or they're importing drugs, whatever, you know, why are you locking up for 20 years? You know, what you need to do is you need to set up a program that actually supports them and actually gets them back into work and then puts them to work. In Scandinavia, they've actually shutting down prisons now where they've taken prisoners in there and they've given them an education, they've given them a degree, they've given them a self-worth and they've given them a skill and they've all come out and the reoffending rate is basically non-existent in some of the Scandinavian countries now. And I've spoken to politicians and I've asked them, why don't we use this? And they said, because Scandinavia is Scandinavia and England is England.
Oh, that's always the same old answer.
For that reason, it won't work. So there's not the will. Could you imagine if half the population of the criminals inside prison actually, if you decriminalized drugs, you know, that would release half the prison. You know, can you imagine that the people that would suffer? You know, the people that suffer the most would be probation officers, solicitors, barristers. You know, their livelihood would go up in smoke. And God forbid anyone takes that away from them. You know, and unfortunately, this is the problem. Too many people and even service providers are eating from that trough. It's a multi-million pound trough. You know, they're earning hundreds of millions of pounds a year. I think 35 billion pounds have been spent in the last 10 years on prisons. But none of that actually goes back to the prisons. It goes to service providers. It goes to prison officers. It goes to solicitors. It goes to everybody else apart from the people that should have been benefiting from it, which was the prisoners or the conditions. You know, the conditions inside prison is getting worse and worse and worse. You have overcrowding. And we keep talking about building more prisons. But, you know, that's not the answer. We've shown year on year and decade on decade that putting people away and throwing away the key just doesn't work. You know, we need to start educating these guys out of poverty. We need to start educating them out of doing what they're doing. But that's the only way we're going to do it. We need to invest in them. But, you know, unfortunately, because we have consecutive governments that get going, and you'll have the Tories will be hard and, no, we're not going to give them this. We're going to treat them like, you know, like animals. And then the Labour get in and they say, no, we're going to treat people like civilians and civility. So, you know, we need to get politics out of the prison system. And we need to let the people that run the prison, the governors and the prison officers, create an environment that works. Because every time a government comes in, they fuck it up, you know, and then they go back to square one. So you imagine, you know, you've got a prison system that actually starts really working, and all of a sudden the government changes and it goes back to square one every single time. Every 4 years, it goes back to square one. Unfortunately, we've had a Tory government for the last 11, but, you know, every 11 years it goes back to square one,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we're definitely going backwards there. Do you feel that a lot of the governors feel their hands are tied? I mean, they just don't have the budget. You hear the same thing. We don't have the budget. We don't have the men. We don't have the manpower or the time. And time seems to be the common thing.
We've got governments running prisons. You know, just one example, the housing inside prison. We have a housing organization called the CRC. You know, it's an American organization. They're part of they've taken part of the probation job now. Yeah, they're part of them now. But the CRC are actually a community interest group run by an American company that failed spectacularly in America. They've got contracts in every single prison. Now, they can't do a referral, so they can't even do a referral to actually refer you into anywhere. So, but all they do is they refer you to go to the council, or they refer you back to your probation officer. Well, I don't see why we are paying them hundreds of millions of pounds a year in every single prison when I can come out of prison and go straight to the council, or I can go straight to my probation officer and ask the same questions. Why do I need someone else to tell me where to go? You know, because I'm going there anyway. It's just crazy. You know, they've got people directing me and they're paying them hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. It's crazy. You know, and the biggest fallacy is when you actually do come out of prison now after 5 or 10 years, is that you go to your council and you say, I've been in prison for the last 8 years. And they actually tell you now they can't help you simply because you intentionally made yourself homeless by going to prison. That's crazy.
I've heard that. Yeah, yeah. It's ridiculous. You can't be. Yeah, I mean, that's what
it's true, because it happened to me. And they said, well, you know, come back in 5 years and prove that you lived in the borough. And then you'll go on the waiting list for 15, and maybe you still won't get a gaff. So I can understand why the prisons are getting fuller and fuller, because there's just not the help, you know. I know most people or most listeners will think, well, you know what, get a job, you know, get yourself a job and do this, because that's what we do. But we're not, you know, we're talking about a very small percentage of the population that go in prison, less than 80,000 people at any one time, you know. And, you know, most of them have had all the advantages and don't deserve it. It seems, you know, they've had good educations, but it's the 40% of that revolving door we need to target. These are the people that have got no education, have got no support network, and nowhere to live. If we hit that 40%, you know, I think we would see a drastic drop in crime and that revolving door. You know, but we're just not prepared to actually look at it in a common sense and give it a common sense approach.
Yeah, we still look at prison as an institution, and I hate that word, institution. You know, that's how we're looking at it. And it's not, you know, and the worst thing is, you know, I spent several years homeless in London, you know, and then several years in London, the way that people look upon you at the same thing, get a job, how can you get a house, go register the council, because you can't, because you don't live in that borough. How can you prove you live in that borough? And when you talk to people who come out of prison, when I was homeless, they all said the same thing. They go in there, and the minute they walk in, from the point of giving their name and starting their whole sentence, they're looked upon as just a number. They're not a human. They're no longer a human being. They're part of a system that is institutionalized. And when they come out, they're still considered part of that institution. You've been there. I'm not going to hire you because you've been in an institution. You know, we need to change the image of prisons and image of prisons.
There's still a stigma. Yeah, there's still a stigma. You know, there's a few organisations now that take on ex-prisoners, but you know what? I think we still think that everyone coming out of prison should be just doing labouring jobs. I've met guys in prison have got degrees. You know, and most of them, are, you know, they could work in schools and teach. You know, they could teach criminology, psychology, sociology. You know, some of them are plaster as electricians, and then unfortunately, because of their criminal record, they just can't come out and do a job. You know,
so my trade.
Yeah, you know, so you know, I think we need to have a twofold approach: teach them a skill in prison, and actually get employers to actually employ these guys coming out, so that way they come straight from prison straight into a job. There's no one bit of time that they're going to fall through the hole. It's because as soon as they come out, if they're in a rented accommodation supported by the government under the proviso that they work, then when they start working, the minute they come out, they then start paying that rent straight away through their employee. So, you know, yeah. So they're then, you know, because there's normally a window of good opportunity. I say three window when most people come out. And they've told everyone they're going to change their lives. They don't want to go back in prison, because most people get roasted in their glasses, and you know they would turn around in the last 3 weeks of their sentence and say, you know what, I'm not going to do nothing ever again because all I want is my freedom. Unfortunately, when you got life issues like bills, rent, food, when you come out, you need money, and if you haven't got that, you're then going to revert back to type. So we need to stop them reverting back to type by putting them straight into employment and giving them somewhere to live, and really start that process, and they're starting running as soon as they leave prison. Because at the moment, they've got all good intentions, but the minute they get out of prison, they're being held back. You know,
reading an article just now about a particular prison in Leeds just now doing a high education program, teaching them science and arithmetic and English and all that. That's fantastic. But like you say, when they come out, what good is that? Because we have a CRB system, you know, and a DBS system that says no. You can't do these jobs. Everything you've learned, all that trade that you've learned in prison is useless. So you're just going to come back out with all these little bits of paper that mean absolutely nothing. And yet we're crying out for HGV drivers. We release prisoners with 6 months to go. So what we could do is, the government's crying out for HGV drivers, let's teach them HGV. You know, give them something, give them an opportunity, give them a trade they can actually use. We're crying out for builders, we're crying out for plasterers, electricians, gasmen. So teach them a trade that they can actually do. You know, I see a lot of chefs, teach them a lot of chefs, but let's be honest, the catering industry, they're not going to get, most of them have violence against them. So most hotels and catering are not going to hire them because they've got violence. They're going to let them use knives, aren't they? Even though they've been in prison learning how to cook. These are pointless, wasted exercises.
They've done a thing called a clink inside prison. It was like a restaurant, and it was so successful they opened it in Brixton, and that showed you that the most prisoners are prepared to actually, you know, try it. You know, they've actually opened it up now in a few prisons. So that gives you hope that, you know, that if you give people an opportunity to change, they will. And that's a perfect example of change inside prison, the clink. Yeah, there's also lots of examples of people doing computer courses in prison, plastering, bricklaying, and these guys come out, and because they've got that, they've learned that new skill, they're less likely to reoffend again. But unfortunately, these are very few and far between. You know, they're little courses and they're in little prisons, but it should be widespread. It should be compulsory to actually.
Absolutely.
If you go to prison and you're doing more than 5 years, then part of your prison sentence. Look, if I said to you, I'm going to give you 10 years in prison, yeah, even though your prison sentence is it should only be five, I'm going to give you five, I'm going to give you 10 years, and you're going to have to do 10 years, or you go inside and do this 5 years and you don't cause any trouble, you come off drugs, you do education every other day, and you do an apprenticeship. What would you choose?
Yeah, exactly. Straight away, you're going to say, I'll take that.
So that's what we need to offer them. So we need to say, look, you either do 10 years or you do five, but in that 5 years, you've got to do this. And most people will take that carrot and run with it. I know I would. You know what I mean? I wouldn't waste my time sitting in prison on a PlayStation, you know?
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
You know, I think that answers your other question, what would I do? I think it's about empowering the guys to actually to do something. And it's also about telling the estate, the prison estate, and the authorities, that maybe it's time for actually to man up and actually make these guys do something instead of sitting in their cells. But you know, you need that cost money, you know, to actually put these guys through that. You're going to need skilled tradesmen in there to actually teach them. So that's what we need to do. We need to, you know, we need to make these prisons warehouses where people can learn, not just warehouses where you can just store these
warehouses.
Guys.
Yeah. Not institutions. Let's make them warehouses. where they learn something and they learn a trade. I mean, the word rehabilitation is so easily used and thrown around by people in suits. They like to use that word. That's there. I believe in the Shawshank Redemption, Morgan Freeman says it beautifully. Rehabilitation is just a fancy word that you guys like to use, you know. But the truth is, unless there is something to offer them, we're just putting them right back into a system where they could end up actually advancing in the career of criminality and coming back out, or especially with the young ones, when they go into these young offenders, it's just they're going in, they're grouping back up. They're grouping back up with people from their own area, and it's continuous. So when they come back out, they're brought straight back into the gang situation, and it just increases, and there's nothing for them. But when you talk to them, you talk to these people away from it, they'll say, I just want to do something, you know, I want to make my mum proud, or I want to make my family proud. I just want to do something with my life, but what can I do? I need money. I need to be able to, I haven't got a career. I haven't got any kind of education. What can I do? And instead of politicians ruling prisons, it's time to let governors govern their prisons and give them the money, definitely. Give them manpower.
That's the biggest thing. I think we need to take politics out of it. We need to cap it so they can't get involved. You know, we've had Grayling that went in there and said, like, we're going to stop giving people books and stamps. This is his way of teaching people that, you know. But just in the last couple of days, we've had the Tory conference, and the best they can come up with is that we're going to double and quadruple the people that we take. Like, that's going to solve anything. You know, it's just crazy. We've had G4S here, you know, for the last 10 years, taking over the security of some of the prisons, and they failed spectacularly. They also took over the tagging of prisoners. And what they put so many false claims in and made up names of people they were tagging, and they took millions out of the system, and then and it came on top. But instead of getting rid of G4S, what did they do? They gave them a fine and let them carry on. What sort of message does that send out to the prisoners? Is that because this is a big corporate organization that's got fingers in every aspect of criminal prisons now? Is it because they're so big, they're actually too big to actually prosecute? You know, so they find them. So what, you know, that says there's one law for you lot and one law for us. And now, unfortunately,
there is a famous case just now, is a case of a gentleman being recalled to prison because of his tagging, you know, when he breached his tagging on the way, but he didn't, you know.
No, never. He was outside that's Kevin Lane. He was outside the exclusion zone. However, because of his probation officer was at a soft spot for him in a way that he didn't like him, he then decided to actually recall him. And no matter, even though we proved the case against the probation officer that he was wrong, it's now going to take 18 months to actually go through the process of getting him out again. So, you know, regardless of whether he was right or wrong, he was always going to be wrong anyway, simply because of the way the prison system's set up. Because you have to go through a judicial system that actually takes forever. You know, like if you look at the Guildford Four, you look at, you know, any cases, you know, they wait 24 years or 25 years before they admit the fact they made a mistake, you know. Yeah. And this, unfortunately, has happened time and time and time again in this country. So, you know, I know Kevin really well, and I'm actually going to go down to a march in 10 down the street on the 21st of October to actually show my support for him. And we're taking quite a lot of people down there.
I hope so. And I hope everybody's listening to this, they can join that and help support this gentleman, because I've read quite a bit about it, and it's a shock miscut. It is one of the, you know, because it's not what you'd call high profile to some people, but it is. This is a man's life they've just taken away from him, you know.
Well, you know, and what? You know, if you look at the case, you know, this is a case where you had two other defendants, who were caught in the car, they're driving that car. But because of their fingerprints weren't in it, they were actually asked to go evidence because they found Kevin's fingerprint on the back. So he then he was prosecuted, and the police officer that actually brought them two witnesses into the case, he was actually charged a few years later with stealing £160,000. I think he got 4 years in prison. And also the two guys actually were in that car. They actually were convicted, I think 2 years later, of a contract killing. You know, but still, they didn't see fit to actually exonerate Kevin and get him out of prison, because they'd made up their mind that he was guilty. You know, and this is after it was proved that these two guys were liars, and it was proven that the officer who actually was in charge of the case was very corrupt. But still, he still languishes in prison. It's crazy.
Yep. And even most people don't realize this guy was actually rebuilding his life and doing well with his life. He was getting on with his life. You know, we're not talking about a guy here who'd come out and was a career criminal in hiding. This guy was rebuilding his life and doing well in his life, you know?
Yeah, he was doing really well. He was working with us and changing life with Daniel Knife. He was doing talks. You know, he was doing really, really well. And all of a sudden, he got recalled again for no reason whatsoever. You know, being in the right place at the right time, he was then penalized for it. You know, it's crazy.
Ridiculous. And that sums our system up right now.
Yeah, but you know what? So, but unfortunately, when you come up against a brick wall and you've done it time and time again, it doesn't really, you know, you know how corrupt it is. But you know, people, unfortunately, you know, they only see what they want to see and they hear what they want to hear. But unfortunately, the truth really gets buried somewhere in that. You know, and unfortunately, this has happened to Kevin. I know Kevin for 24 years, and you know, he's maintained his innocence for 24 years. So. You know, I don't know any man that would actually want to stay in prison, because I think they offered him to be released years and years ago. But he said, "Why would I go guilty if I'm innocent?" So you know, I believe him wholeheartedly, and so does a lot of people. Paul Ferris, where you are, believes him wholeheartedly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean,
James English. You know, we've all been spoken to Kevin. We've all been and had a chat with him. You know, and they've all known him for years. You know, and he's one honest guy. You know,
yeah, he's the kind of guy that takes responsibility. He's never been one for shouting his responsibility. I suppose, I mean, you could say less. I've done it, fair cop. You know what I mean? But I've done nothing wrong here. You know, and he's just it's and I don't class him as a victim. He's not a victim here. He is is persecuted here. He is just simply. I think it's a system.
Yeah, I think we was at the stage where Panorama were doing a thing on him. And they found out all this evidence about the police officer, about these guys being corrupt, about being done for a contract, killing themselves. It was all about to be exposed. So what do? They pulled him back in again. So, you know, why he's in prison, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, we believe this is the reason why they pulled him back in prison.
Yep. It's nice to cover up, isn't it? It's nice to put a blanket over things that suit them. It's always their type of blanket, isn't it?
Yeah, because he's very articulate. He's well-educated. You know, he's learned a lot in prison. Most of us, unfortunately, the biggest mistake that the prison authority has ever done, unfortunately, was educating prisoners. You know, we were allowed to go to education. You know, I suffer with dyslexia. And when I went into prison, I came out and I've written 10 books. You know, so, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me is I actually went to prison and got educated. So, you know,
You're a prime example of success. You know, you've taken that. And you've taken it to teach people as well. And your books are brilliant, you know. And you've got a new book coming out, I believe.
Yeah, I've got. Well, Verizon just been released. I've got a book coming out Christmas called Finding Anna. It's about, you know, I met lots of guys since I come out of prison that self isolate, that believe there's more behind them than there is in front of them. So what they do, they carry on drinking, they self medicate, they, you know, they stay in, and they don't look after themselves. And I'm saying, well, you know, I came out of prison. And I never had nothing apart from a tent, you know. And what I did, I groomed myself. I started getting out there. I started mixing, and I started training, and you know, and I made myself into a better person, so I could find someone that I could love. And luckily for me, I did. And people say, well, if you're stuck in your ways, you're stuck in your way. But I knew one guy that was stuck in his ways for years. But he followed my advice. He went training. We went training over the heath together. He started looking after himself, and he's met a beautiful young lady now. So, you know, it does work. And I just wanted to write something that would be comical, would have a little bit of humor to it, but also a message to say, you know, it's never too late to give up, guys, you know? So, yeah, so I wrote Finding Anna, you know, and it's hopefully been released in the next month or so. And I've also got a kid's book coming out at the end of this month, simply because I want to donate that to the schools free of charge. Because they've done such a wonderful job through the pandemic. You know, most of the teaching assistants and teachers actually went to work every single day through the pandemic. You know, and they seem to be the forgotten heroes of this world, because they looked after the doctor's kids and the surgeon's kids and everybody's kids while they were able to carry on and run the country. You know, so, you know, the reason I know this is because my girlfriend is a teacher, teaching assistant. And she worked every single day, and you know, she knew the consequences, and she knew the dangers of going in every day, but she still went, which is admirable. And so I wrote a book about my two dogs and illustrated it, and it should be out soon.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. If you could go back and speak to 11-year-old self, if you could go back to you when you were 11-year-old, what would you say to yourself, Terry?
You know, I'd say, you know, regardless of no matter how much I hated school, you know, I really should have just gone and educated myself. You know, because, you know, there's so much to be said for education. You can educate yourself about poverty. And I think if I educated myself, there'd have been so many opportunities that I could have taken. Unfortunately, I shut that door because I went into crime. You know, so, you know, I'm responsible for everything that's happened to me simply because I never buckled down and went to school. But that would be the advice I would give anybody. Go to school and educate yourself.
What's your biggest regret in life, Terry?
My biggest regret. I don't know. You know what? Looking back over it now, you know, I don't think I would change anything. You know, I think I had to go through what I did to actually have
get to where you are.
To be where I am now. You know, I work. You know, I came out of prison and I couldn't get a job. So what I did, I started up my own business called Scoff Meals, and now we do nutritional meals to the stars and to people that want to change their life. You know, and I started with my two daughters and one of their boyfriends, and now we employ 23 people. So, you know, so unless I actually went through what I did and had that determination to get through it and actually come out and actually do what I'm doing now, you know, I regrets, I don't think I have any now. I think if we all look back, we'd say yes, of course I regret it because, you know, I never saw my kids growing up, but that would be a pretty helpful one.
And looking out towards the youth, if you could send a message out to the young people, the young kids and the people in London today, what would your message be to, in fact, to all young kids just now who are at that crossways in their life? What would be your message to them right now?
For me, it's, you know, just you know, believe in yourself. You know, you don't have to have people that carry knives and commit crime and you know, use incautious as violence to, and you don't need to aspire to being like them. You know, empower yourself by being an individual person, you know, and then going out there and making something of yourself.
That's brilliant, Terry. I like that. And who can they get in touch with? If they're at a crossroads, who would you recommend getting in touch with? This is your chance to sort of name some people.
If they got a problem with drugs, you know, the Forward Trust is a really good organization that helps people. They you know, so the Forward Trust, you can get in touch with them on social media. If you have got trouble with gangs and you want to get out of it, you know, contact Ben Spann, Change Your Life, Put Your Knife, or Michelle at Camden Against Violence, because, you know, she will be able to direct you away from the gangs and into education and hopefully back into college. You know, so there's plenty of opportunities for them to change life. But as I said, you have to really want to do it. And the only way, so we can't, no matter how much we talk, we can't change their perception or their life. They have to really want to do it. And there are a lot of kids now who are coming away from it. You know, they're seeing that that really the life of being in a gang is nothing to aspire to now. And you know what? And unfortunately, as every one kid gets killed, you know, we then gain three or four who want to come out of the gang. So unfortunately, it's a never-ending cycle of, one kid dies, three come out. You know, eventually it will run its course. It's just when, you know, will it take another 4 years, 5 years, or 10 years? But we advocate early intervention. So we believe now, you know, we can't buy our way out of this. We can't arrest our way out of this. So what we need to do, we need to start in the schools. We need to start teaching these kids about embarrassment, ego, shame, and showing them that they don't physically hurt. So they don't have to retaliate in a way that causes someone else harm. It's just accepted for the fact of what it is. It's just a word. And it's just a feeling. It doesn't physically hurt. Yeah, and I think once we empower them with that, I think we start having better kids. We start setting them up to succeed instead of setting them up to fail.
Yeah, and that's not a London model. That's a UK model. That has to be spread out across the whole UK, because that is fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they've got somewhere they can go to and talk to and learn that, you know. I hate the word, you know, show face and respect and all that, you know. Yeah. They're just words, you know. Words
don't it's just nothing. Yeah. I think once you get rid of the ego, you know, I made a conscious effort to wear coloured socks. You know, I'm 6'2", and I was built like a shithouse for years. So what I did, I had to make myself more accessible to people because I got quite a rough voice. So what I do now is I wear different coloured socks every day, and I wear shorts, and people look at me and they look at my socks and they normally laugh or smile. So that sort of breaks the ice, and it's because I've got, as I said, I've got rough voice. But so it's really making a conscious effort to actually change how people perceive you. So if you're dressing wearing a hoodie and you're wearing a mask and you're looking at people and you're expecting them to respond in a way that is favourable to you, then you're barking at the wrong tree. You need to dress in a way that engages people instead of pushing them away. You need to smile.
If you could address the media right now and ask the media to change one thing, what would you ask the media to change?
Just start speaking the truth. You know, tell them what the real issues are in the community. You know, this ain't about youth clubs. This ain't about anything other than teaching the parents, teaching the kids. You know, that there's more to life than violence. You know, I unfortunately get lots of parents come up to me. And they say my kid's smoking dope and he's getting in trouble and he's drinking and all that. And I say, do you smoke dope in front of him? And they say, yeah, but, you know, it's different for me because I'm his parent. And I say, yeah. Your kids will mirror you. If you're arguing in front of him and you're swearing at him, he's going to mirror that. So we need to teach our adults to actually be a bit more responsible. We need to train everybody. So this, as I said, early intervention, if we start with the young kids growing up, we teach them to articulate, to treat the elders with respect, then the next generation will come up, will do the same, next one, and we sort of breed it out of them, because at the moment their role models are people that smoke gear, take crack, take heroin, drive fast cars, BMWs and everything else. That's their role models, and they're all on social media with guns and knives and balaclavas. So we need to eradicate all that shit. We need to change that model. We need kids that are going to, we need to, if we were going to get the media involved, we need to show them kids that are in academies, that, you know, little young kids are 16, 17, they're in college, and show them that anyone is capable of doing it, you know? And once we change that narrative, I think kids will start looking at different role models. You know, they're going to look at the kid on the corner who's got a really great job at 21, you know, instead of working in McDonald's, which is not a bad thing because the kids are still working. But you know, it's just about, you know, giving them the right role models, you know, instead of these other mugs.
I agree.
When I, as I said, I've done quite a few years in prison. And the funny thing is that most of these guys that kill people are mugs. They're insecure. They're irrelevant. You know, they're afraid of their own shadow. So what they normally do, they carry a knife because they're so inadequate, and they would stab you and because they're afraid of getting hurt, because they don't understand. They've never been in the gym, they've never been in the ring, so they fear being hurt so much that they would rather stab you than actually fear, you know, get a whack on the chin. But the funny thing is, once they stab someone, they're now in prison with the worst people in society, and they're going to be in that well for the next 15 or 20 years. So what they tried to escape from, they just dug a massive hole and they've left themselves in the shit for 20 odd years. And their life's terrible in prison, because I see them come in. They normally end up themselves, or they end up isolating themselves, and they never come out of their cells. And this is their future if they carry a knife.
Yep, absolutely. You know, they come in and there's no ego there when they're walking in through them big doors and they put them blue stripes on. You know, when they walk through them doors, you know, firstly, you're in amongst guys like you say that don't need to go stabbing someone to get the point across. You know, men. And like I say, they'll stay in their cells, and they usually, their first night in jail usually involves crying a little lies out. The next 48 hours, probably most of them attempt to commit suicide, like you say, and that, of course, just increased suicide, you know. So, yeah, I totally think that's a brilliant statement, Terry. I like that, you know, and it dresses it up exactly how it is, you know. Yeah. When you put that knife in your pocket and you step outside, you know, you're signing a contract, you know. Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I wrote Living Amongst the Beasts, because, you know, I learned so much in that prison. You know, I was told by lots of people not to go there. You know, lots of top villains. I got some really good top villain friends. And they said, why the fuck would you want to go there for? And I said, because I've had enough of prison. You know, I've had enough of listening to the same old jokes, you know, going through the same old shit, and then going to the end of it and starting all again. You know, I want to give myself an opportunity to change. And I think going to Grendon was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, you know. One was being surrounded by all these beasts, you know, but at the same time, you know, putting all their offences aside, I had to look at me and how I treated people. And I think once I started working on me, I then began to change. you know, and everything I learned, you know, I wrote down in Living Amongst the Beasts. Because, as I said, it's very provocative, but you know, there's so many. I've had messages from all around the world, from men and women who have been empowered by what I learned in there to actually change their lives. And they still continue to write to me and message me all the time. You know, so you know, it does work on so many levels. It's not the cure, but it works on so many levels to helping you find yourself.
Yeah, I like that. And looking to the future, Terry, what does the future hold for Terry Ellis?
You know, as I said, we got Scoff Mills now. It's going really well. I'm working with my daughters and my son-in-law. We're going from strength to strength. It's a real good young company, and everyone works because they're all invested in it. So that's for me. That's my future, and also just trying to help as many people as I can. You know, get my books out there. They're all self-help books, and I'm a born again Christian. So for me, it's about giving back instead of taking.
And how can folk get hold of your books, Terry?
My books on Amazon. If they put Terry Ellis books, you know, Living Amongst the Beast, Verizon, The Final Countdown, and I actually wrote a book about. It's called HMP. It's called Help Me Prepare. It's for first time offenders and their families. It just tells them really to, instead of getting involved in the gangs and the drugs, they should get involved in education, go on drug courses, and really empower themselves, because they're never ever going to get an opportunity to change their life as much as they do when they go in prison. And I'm a perfect ambassador for that, because, you know, I went in prison. I was a drug user. I smoked. I drank. I done therapy, and I dealt with all my problems. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't take drugs anymore. Not because of any other reason. It's that I don't need them now, man. Because I sorted my head out, and I only done that by learning everything I did from Living Amongst the Beasts.
Absolutely brilliant, Terry. Terry, I want to thank you for taking your time out. I know you're a busy guy, and I appreciate you talking to you. Wee guy like me up here in the north, I really appreciate it, and thank you for letting me reach out to you. Terry, I always play a song for my guests. Okay, if I could play you any song, which song could I play for you, Terry?
Oh God, you know what? I think what resonates with me? I think anything from Coldplay. You know, Coldplay was really instrumental in it was in a time in my life that always reminds me of prison. Every time I listen to Coldplay or David Gray, always reminds me of prison, because the most of the words are very poignant to me. Babylon.
I was going to say, how about I play Babylon for you, Terry?
Yeah, it'd be brilliant, brother. I really appreciate it.
Well, look, Terry, thank you for coming on Late District Radio, and thank you for coming on the Dennis Devlin Show. I feel honoured and privileged to have even had the opportunity to speak to you. I thank you for the work you're doing right now, and I hope people listening right now, if you've got young people out there you're worried about, you know, reach out. There are people out there. You know, it's a frightening time we live in just now. Nobody wants to see any more people die in the streets. And I can't thank you enough, Terry, for the work you do.
No, thank you. You know what? You know, on a better note, it is getting better. You know, it's empowered lots of people to go out there. There's more civilians. There's more community workers now than ever before helping the community. So you know what? There is some good happening. You know, so it's not all bad. It's all doom and gloom.
Terry, thank you very much. I'm Dennis Devlin. This is the Dennis Devlin Show. We've been talking to Terry Ellis, and this is La Vida from Coldplay.
Thank you, brother.
Say that I can't hear, that I can't think straight, like a rain cloud pouring on my brain, and I don't know if I'll be alright. The worst thing is that it all goes back to us. Like I'm tired of working for your love, cause I don't really know if we will be alright. Three sides to the story, everything true except for me and you. Oh, this is my shot. I'm sorry I got to give what I got before it goes. You here, but I know I'm scared of living on my own, cause I don't know if I'll be alright. I canceled any plans that I've got left, might as well have a knife run through my chest, cause I don't really
not a fool. I know they hate me for telling the truth, but I don't mind though. I got pride, oh, I'm coming through. Yeah, yeah.
I'm a dog, so what a good night. I got champagne in my head flash. I'ma get drunk, trying to let go. Give the angel from my shadow. I don't feel alone when there's no one home. Like a sketch up when they're on the run. But I'm not running from myself, 'cause I got another side. When it takes control, don't know where to draw the line. Damn, not it's all the same, but I'm alright. Ordinary in my life. It's better to be a freak of nature than to live for life. 'Cause I'm on the other side, looking at that, watching people waste their time. Seven glasses in cyberspace, but I'm alright. Ordinary in my life.
The Dennis Devlin Show. You can catch The Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio every Saturday afternoon from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Join me as we travel through the decades and play you the biggest hits from the 60s,
the 70s, the 80s, the 90s and the noughties. That's The Dennis Devlin Show on Lake District Radio every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. The Dennis Devlin Show. We play you
the best mix of music.